Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Eva Gollinger, an attorney living in Caracas, who assesses the Bush administration's renewed campaign challenging the government of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Tom Stokes of the Climate Crisis Coalition, who explains why his organization launched a campaign in the U.S. to collect signatures supporting a people's ratification of the Kyoto Protocol to control global warming. And attorney Michael Krinsky, who analyzes the latest OFAC regulation, which allows collaboration between persons in the United States and Cuba for publishing activities under a general license. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A new report by Amnesty International concludes that women in Iraq have made no progress since the U.S. military overthrew the government of Saddam Hussein. The report condemns the lawlessness and increased killings, as well as abductions and rape of women that has overtaken Iraq in the last 2 years. In addition, Amnesty warns that women can be beaten by their husbands under existing Iraqi law. Local prosecutors are allowed to hand down lenient sentences to perpetrators of so-called honor killings of women who are believed to have engaged in behavior dishonoring their families. In the coming months, Amnesty International will be working for strong measures to protect women's rights in Iraq's newly elected National Assembly, who will write the nation's new constitution. In its report, Amnesty says that activists with the Organization for Women's Freedom in Iraq have received emailed death threats from the Islamic faction known as the Army of Sahaba. Amnesty has also sent out an urgent alert about the fate of Baghdad businesswoman Huda Hafez Ahmed al-Azawi, who on February 17th was taken along with her daughters from their home by U.S. soldiers and members of the Iraqi National Guard. She was accused of supporting the resistance. In December 2003, al-Azawi was detained at the infamous Abu Ghraib prison. She was released last July and complained about being tortured. For now, Amnesty is requesting that the Iraqi government state where al-Azawi is being held and provide her access to a lawyer. For a second time in a month, a major international treaty is going into effect without the support of the Bush administration. On February 27th, the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control became law after 57 nations ratified the treaty, including the European Union, Japan, and Australia. The Tobacco Convention was supported by the World Health Assembly in May 2003, as 170 nations signed the treaty, including the United States. But the Bush administration never sent it to the U.S. Senate for ratification, much like the way in which the White House withdrew from the Kyoto Protocol on global warming. As John Kirkwood, president of the American Lung Association, commented, "The United States has a long history of signing treaties but not ratifying them. The stakes in tobacco control are too high for this treaty to meet the same fate." The convention was negotiated over 4 years in conjunction with the World Health Organization. It bans tobacco advertising, promotion, and sponsorships. The treaty also requires warning labels on cigarette packs and bans misleading terms like low tar, light, and mild. According to the website oneworld.net, smoking rates in the U.S. and Western Europe have fallen in recent years, while tobacco giants like British American Tobacco or Philip Morris Altria have focused their marketing campaigns on developing nations in Asia and Latin America, where 70% of all tobacco deaths occur. A graduate research project turned deadly for Jeff Kaminsky, who was doing fieldwork on the impact of logging on small mammals in Appalachia. In July 2004, he died of HPS, hantavirus pulmonary syndrome, a rare infection spread by exposure to infected rodents' saliva, feces, or urine. The disease first appeared in 1993 in the southwestern United States. Nearly 40% of humans infected with HPS die. Scientists say it was triggered by a heavy snow and rainfall that ended a 6-year drought. According to E, the environmental magazine, HPS is one of a flurry of animal diseases infecting and killing humans. The most troubling recent outbreak was seen in deaths in Cambodia, Thailand, and Vietnam, attributed to the avian bird flu. Now, the World Health Organization is warning of a possible global pandemic from the bird flu. The rapid spread of the West Nile virus and Lyme disease in the United States are some of the best-known examples of a disease carried by an animal that has infected people. According to the British-based Center for Tropical Veterinary Medicine, 60% of all infections that harm humans are transmitted by animals. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
Although the left has gained ground throughout Latin America, with the recent election of progressive heads of state in Argentina, Brazil, Ecuador, and most recently Uruguay, the White House has singled out populist Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez as the region's most potentially unstable government and a threat to democracy. Since President Bush's re-election victory last November, his administration has been engaged in an escalating war of words against Venezuela, the fourth largest supplier of crude oil to the U.S. The Bush administration is widely believed to have played a supporting role in the April 2002 coup against Chavez, later reversed by a popular uprising. Since then, Washington has helped finance groups that organized last August's failed national recall referendum aimed at forcing the populist president from office. Chavez, who now has won two presidential elections and six referendums, is expected to run for re-election when his current term ends in 2006. Recent attacks from Washington include charges that Venezuela's new media law will silence Chavez's critics, and the government's plan to purchase arms from Russia and patrol planes from Brazil constitute a regional threat. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Eva Gollinger, an attorney and investigative reporter currently in Caracas, who assesses the Bush administration's renewed campaign to challenge the government of Hugo Chavez.
In about the second week of January of this year, a campaign was launched in the media, primarily in the United States, actually in major newspapers such as the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, LA Times, the Chicago papers, the Miami Herald, of course, can't forget that, also the Financial Times and other smaller newspapers around the country, criticizing the Chavez administration, but in a sort of a different tone as had been done before, because most of those media outlets I named have been very critical of the Venezuelan government over the past few years. The same arguments that were being put forward in the newspapers were being reiterated generally after, oftentimes before, by Department of State spokespeople. We've seen this before back in the 1980s with Nicaragua and when Otto Reich was the head of the Office for Public Diplomacy, an office which was shut down within a period of 2 years because it was discovered that the office was engaging in basically a dirty media war and black propaganda tactics by publishing bogus stories and under either false reporters' names or paying reporters to publish information favorable to the U.S. government and unfavorable to the Sandinistas, which is similar to what we see here in Venezuela. And it seems to be happening at the same time when it's being discovered that the Bush administration is also financing journalists. When Condoleezza Rice was being sworn in or had her confirmation hearings in the Congress, and she discussed Venezuela and claimed that Chavez was a negative force for the region, something the United States couldn't just sit by and let him to continue to do what he's doing in this area, and basically he's a threat to democracy.
Washington has criticized Hugo Chavez's regime for purchases of weapons from Brazil and Russia, and also been quite critical of a new media law put in place by the government of Hugo Chavez, which they say restricts freedom of the press. You want to just give us your brief view on that?
Sure. I'll briefly mention the arms race that the United States is trying to warn the world about is another part of the massive political and media campaign. The Venezuelan government entered into a contract to buy some weapons from Russia, but they have reiterated over and over again that they're just to replace old weapons that are no longer of any use that the Venezuelan armed forces currently is working with or has in their possession. So basically just a replacement. There are no MiGs that are going to be bought, as has been repeated and picked up over and over again in different newspapers in the United States. That's just an outright falsehood. And there's no buildup happening here either of any kind of arms. Chavez or the administration are not arming the populace. I mean, all of that is basically just made up to stir up some kind of a fear that there's a threat down here in Venezuela close to the United States or that in some way could put in danger the supply of oil to the United States from Venezuela. Regarding the media law that was passed actually last year, the law of social responsibility in radio and television was a law that has been in the works for about 3 years. Actually, it preceded even the coup in 2002. And, well, I don't know if any of the listeners have ever been down to Venezuela and seen the private media channels, but it's like 1,000 times worse than Fox Cable News. And we're talking every channel except the state-owned channel. And not just with political opinions, but in terms of presenting outright lies, lots of violence. There was a lot of soft porn, and sometimes even beyond that, during daytime hours. So basically this law, the law of social responsibility in radio and television, is to put some kind of control on sex and violence that can be shown during children's and family viewing hours. Once again, the United States, Department of State, together with U.S. media and, you know, Venezuelan private media, have launched this massive campaign saying freedom of speech and expression is being stifled and the government censoring the media. But that's absolutely absurd. I mean, you turn on any of the channels here and you'll see that there is more freedom of expression enjoyed in Venezuela than probably anywhere else in the world. It's the only place where they can go on television and talk about, you know, killing the president or saying the most derogatory and offensive things on a news hour.
Ava Gullinger, just to conclude here, with Washington making hostile noises towards the government of Hugo Chavez, what is the concern down there among people in Venezuela, and what is being done to counter what the U.S. Might have in mind for Hugo Chavez?
Well, placing the public on high alert and denouncing constantly all these types of scare tactics or media campaigns is basically what the government is doing and what those who support, you know, this government and don't support those types of tactics are doing. It's basically keeping it in the public light. So, the more people know, hopefully the less likely it will happen. At the same time, there are fears because outside of the United States, most people tend to be more conscious and aware of what the United States is doing in the rest of the world. So people here are very aware of the fact that the U.S. has acted preemptorily in Iraq and in other places, and that it could do the same thing here unilaterally as well. And there are fears, although maybe, you know, something pretty far away, of an invasion of some sort or an intervention, be it through utilizing the United Nations or the Organization of American States. It seems like that would be not very possible at this moment. But then again, you know, the Bush administration has shown that it can basically do whatever it wants. And we are talking about the country that supplies the most oil to the United States in this region. So there is a very, very, very high security interest in removing Chavez, because Chavez obviously threatens the steady supply of oil to the United States. At least that's how they see it, even though there's been no alteration in any kind of oil supply, except during the strike that the opposition held in the end of 2002 for 64 days in the oil industry, where they sabotaged the refineries. And so Venezuela was unable to comply with a lot of its production contracts. But apart from that, there hasn't been a threat or a diminishment of supply. Chavez has said, though, and other members of the government have also said, that if the United States were to take any kind of an action against Venezuela, then they could certainly count on the fact that the oil supply would not remain as stable.
That was Eva Gullinger, an attorney and investigative reporter currently in Venezuela. Read her articles online at www.venezuelaanalysis.com or www.venezuelafoia.info. The Kyoto Protocol to reduce global warming went into effect on February 16th. The United States, which produces one quarter of all the Earth's greenhouse emissions, particularly carbon dioxide, withdrew from the treaty because President George W. Bush said it would cost U.S. jobs and hurt the economy. Meanwhile, the increase in weather-related catastrophes around the globe, such as hurricanes and floods, as well as significant melting of ice at both poles, is proof to virtually all environmental scientists that climate change is well underway and, by some estimates, may become irreversible in 10 years. The day the Kyoto Treaty came into force, a group called the Climate Crisis Coalition launched a petition drive for a people's ratification of the Kyoto Protocol, a grassroots effort to bring the United States in line with the rest of the world. Reaching out to groups from the peace, environmental, labor, and indigenous movements in the U.S., the coalition has already collected 13,000 signatures. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Tom Stokes, coordinator of the coalition, about why his group initiated the petition campaign and what organizers hope to accomplish.
We really started this with a dual mission. One is to do whatever we could to put climate issues on the front burner of the political agenda in this country, and the other is to broaden the circle of people engaged in this issue. beyond the traditional environmental groups. We've really coalesced around three primary projects. One is the people's ratification of the Kyoto Global Warming Treaty. The other is a series of town meetings around the country where we connect the local with the global, if you will. And the third is mobilization efforts to really organize direct actions, marches, vigils, rallies, things of this sort.
The petition isn't really addressed to anyone, like the president or the Congress. How do you see it as having an impact?
It's a symbolic document, if you will. I mean, obviously, this is not a petition that's going to have any legal bearings. It's a vehicle for people to say, if the U.S. isn't going to sign, well, we will, because we're citizens and we think our country should. We're going to use this to provide leverage where we best can. We will certainly use it at international meetings where the U.S. has noticeably not been a player. The follow-up meetings of the Kyoto Protocol, where implementation measures are being discussed. There's one scheduled for Montreal in November. That it will be a natural venue to come forward. And really, the U.S. can say at that organizing meeting that, well, we in the United States don't feel that we can afford to abide by this because it's going to cost jobs. We can be there and say, well, we have 900,000 Americans who say quite the contrary, whatever number we might have then. One of our programs, as I said, it has to do with local town meetings. It's a way to contact people in the various communities, people who have signed this petition, who say their interest is, who say they want to do something, who say they want to commit to a clean energy future, to bring people together, to find a common agenda in the various communities, to build some positive action. If people are just going to sign and think, well, they've done their bit and they can go back to their regular lives, that's going to do nothing. The entire measure of effectiveness is what comes afterwards, what we do in fact do, how we use this petition, how we can engage people who have signed. People by signing it say that they commit to a clean energy future. Well, are they going to respond as we contact them in the future and work in constructive ways? It's not going to be easy.
So what do you think are the steps that need to be taken to reduce climate change?
A lot of people, I think, are under the impression that there's a technical fix to global warming, that, you know, if we can find a way to reinvent the way we consume power, or if we can, you know, we're going to find some clean automobiles, clean light fixtures, clean this, clean that, and that's going to be the route to ending this incredible increasing amounts of carbon dioxide and parts per million in our atmosphere, which are so worrisome. I think we would argue very strongly that it's probably more a political fix that has to take place than a technical. I mean, they both go hand in hand, but it's we already have the technology in hand. We know what we have to do. There's huge room for efficiency, for conservation, for land use planning that doesn't cut up our green spaces, that allows for less commuting traffic and better efficiency of our resources. A lot of it has to do with lifestyle, how much we consume. We're an enormously wasteful country. A lot of it has to do with values and standards, and I think we would say a sense of moral values, of a sense of stewardship for our resources. To think that, oh, we're going to get the top scientists in the world and have some kind of Manhattan Project that's going to come up with these incredible solutions like, you know, nuclear fusion or something that's going to free us from dependence on fossil fuel is a dangerous kind of mindset.
That was Tom Stokes of the Climate Crisis Coalition. For more information or to sign the petition, call the coalition at area code 413-637-2486 or visit their website at www.climatecrisiscoalition.org. On December 14, 2004, the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, added a general license for publishing activities to the Cuban Assets Control Regulations. This general license essentially permits collaboration of U.S. persons and Cubans in the creation of books, manuscripts, journals, and newspapers for publication never before permitted by the U.S. However, the regulation exempts any agencies or instrumentalities within the government of Cuba, though nowhere in the Cuban Assets Control Regulations does it define exactly what is actually meant by agencies or instrumentalities. The general license does not authorize travel to Cuba, permit activities solely because they are in written form, or allow the export of technology that was already prohibited. Considering the increased travel restrictions by the Bush administration, this latest regulation by OFAC appears contradictory and raises many questions. Michael Krinsky is an attorney whose firm has opposed the U.S. imposed travel ban against Americans traveling to Cuba for the past 40-plus years. Your reporter Denise Manzari spoke with Mr. Krinsky, who summarizes and interprets this latest OFAC regulation.
It actually expands somewhat the scope of permissible activity, but it excludes from that expansion the government of Cuba and people working for the government of Cuba.
But under the general license, doesn't it allow people not to have to apply for the special license?
If you want to go to Cuba to arrange a publishing transaction or speak to an author there about publishing, you would still need a specific license from the Treasury Department, and you probably would still get it. In the area of travel, but with respect to other types of activities, there's been a drastic cutback by the Bush administration. First, back in 2003, we saw the Bush administration eliminate these educational programs. And then in 2004, in June, the Bush administration attacked academic travel to Cuba, programs for undergraduate students or graduate students where they were getting credit at the universities, was severely cut back through a variety of techniques. But the end result was, before then, there were probably 300 universities and colleges that were running programs in Cuba. Now it's down to 3 or 4 or 5.
So those cutbacks still exist. However, this general license for publishing activities, what does that actually mean?
It's a bit complicated, and you have to go back to legislation that was passed by Congress called the Free Trade in Ideas Act, and passed in 88, then amended in 94. And that, by an act of Congress, allowed U.S. citizens the right to import informational materials from Cuba.
Is that the Berman Act?
And that's what's called also the Berman Amendment, because named after Congressman Howard Berman from California, who introduced the legislation. But in the last year or so, we've seen the Bush administration, interpreting the Berman Amendment more and more narrowly, and to making it very, very difficult carry on kind of flow of information between the United States and Cuba, and also Iran and the Sudan, which were also affected. The recent amendment corrected those narrowing interpretations for non-Cuban government authors and institutions in Cuba. What has expanded for the non-governmental authors, let's call them that, is for the first time you can commission works in advance and pay in advance, a royalty advance, to enable a Cuban author not working for the government but working for a university or some other entity to sit down, research, and write. That's an expansion. So in other words, you could have an easier time by giving a commissioning a work that you might find interesting from a university professor, but you couldn't make the same kind of arrangement with Fidel Castro under these regulations. And, of course, from the viewpoint of the U.S. citizen, it's really cutting off, or making more difficult anyway, who we can read, the voices we can hear. With all respect to University of Havana professors, you know, there are a lot of people in the U.S. citizens would like to hear from a whole bunch of people in the Cuban government that OFAC is making difficult to work things out with.
When you talk about publishing, immediately we think of textbooks and written material. Does this cover computer-generated internet publication as
well? Yeah, the written word in digital form is covered. But music doesn't work, and film doesn't work.
So it appears on the one hand that they're kind of opening up in the world of publishing. On the other hand, because of the restrictions, it almost seems like a maybe not so subtle continuation of the Track 2 approach of a kinder, gentler way of that separation and alienation of the Cuban government.
Yes, I think you know, the phrase track two is probably apt. You know, it remains to be seen, this litigation, whether it will survive court challenge by a bunch of U.S. publishers, mostly academic publishers, challenge these increasingly tight restrictions on publishing. And Bush administration responded in part to this litigation by the opening we discussed, but kept the restrictive readings of the Berman Amendment with respect to the Cuban government. Remains to be seen what will happen with that litigation, the impact on that distinction the Bush administration is drawing.
I think over the last 40 years, the United States has claimed national security as one of the issues for not traveling to Cuba. Since 9/11, do you think that that still holds true, even though it seems to be a shallow excuse to begin with?
It has gone so shallow, nothing should float on it. You know, the whole travel restrictions were justified in the Supreme Court in case we argued, and, you know, over the years. As national security, in a very classic sense, Cuba was doing things in the international sphere which were contrary to U.S. national security. It was exporting revolution in arms from Latin America. It had troops in Africa. It was allied with the Soviet Union, which had missiles pointed to the United States. When those things ended, the travel restrictions should have ended under the rationales that had been offered successfully in the courts to justify them. Well, that's not the way it worked out. Now the government came and said, no, we don't like Cuba's internal system, and we have to change that. And we're going to use travel as a tool, as a weapon, to try to coerce internal changes in Cuba. And so what the rationale basically is coming down to is U.S. citizens are supposed to give up their rights of travel, of dialogue, of speech with Cubans in order, supposedly, that Cuban citizens can have more rights themselves. And it's a contradiction which I think no one can take seriously.
That was attorney Michael Krinsky. The publication in the Federal Register is available on OFAC's website at www.trej.gov/OFAC in the Recent Actions section. You've been listening to Between the Lines, the weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.